Hello everyone, welcome to Computer Science E75. I'm Dan Armendaris, and this is Section, of course, not Lecture. Here in Section, we are actually just going to, this is a lot more open of a sort of forum. It's much more social, I guess you could say, and certainly it's going to be largely driven by your questions and comments and that sort of thing. We will be going over some of the topics addressed in Lecture because David had to go through them somewhat quickly, but if you have any questions, please do feel free to interrupt me, and we'll go from there. So here we have, of course, the CS75.net, your sort of home base for this semester. And as part of Project Zero, once you purchase your domain name from any number of registrars, not the least of which is GoDaddy, which David showed you a little bit earlier, you'll be given an email with login information to access this portion of the website or CS75.net's panel. So all you have to do is enter in your username and password. If I can remember my password. Let's try that. All right. And then you can go to it brings you to this web page, which shows you a bunch of options for your particular domain. So how many of you have actually finished at least this much of it and have logged into the panel, have a domain name, all that stuff? At least one, two, three. Okay, so most of you, that's pretty good. So have any of you logged into this quite yet? Put any files up and tried it out? Get some XHTML files up on here? All right, so quiet group tonight, no problem. And so here, there's a number of portions of this that actually can make things somewhat easy. There are a number of panels available from different hosting companies, but this one, DirectAdmin, is just one that David happens to like using. So let's say that you want to start adding files. You can start writing XHTML files on your computer and view them, of course, by opening them in your web browser locally. But this doesn't mean that just because you're viewing the web page doesn't mean that it's actually up on the internet. So what you can do is, after you log into DirectAdmin, you can click on the File section here, go to your Public HTML section, and from there you will be able to upload particular files with the... There's an upload around here somewhere. All the way down. Well, somewhere around here. So you upload your files. You can also create new directories, which are just folders, and so on and so forth. So there's... also, of course, other ways that you can log in to the host in order to upload files, and that is with SFTP, which, of course, just means it's secure file transfer. So here I have an example of an SFTP program, as soon as it loads up. All you have to do is you just type in the name of your domain server after you've done at least the beginning steps in Project Zero. So mine was therawfiles.com. You type in your username that was given to you in the email address and the password, which it looks like it may have remembered, but I'll retype it anyway. And you can connect. And it's going to be very, very similar to what you just saw. Double-click on your public HTML folder, and this is pretty much the default. I haven't really touched anything that's in this particular folder. Of course, you can, at any time, go to your website, and you will see that after the host has been connected to it via the name servers that you put in GoDaddy or your own registrar, you'll get this default HTML page. But, of course, you'll want to change this. And that brings us to talking about XHTML. So if you remember from class, let's see if I can make this bigger. If you remember from class, David showed us a very easy, very brief XHTML file, which is just something like this. And so we have the doc type, the HTML open tag, header tag, or the head tag, body tag, and that's about it. Of course, we have to close every tag. And so this is perhaps one of the most basic web pages that you'll ever see, but it's certainly a valid one. And it is one that if we were to go to the website, it actually looks like a respectable website. So here, Moulin Rouge. So one of the big things that this course, that you have to pay attention to in this course is the validity and the well-formedness of your XHTML documents. And all this means really is that for every open tag that you have, you must close it. Now, you'll remember that there were some examples of tags that do not have this sort of notion, it doesn't make sense to have a closed tag. Some of you have any recollection of what some of those might be? Yeah, okay, a line break. There's one more big one that's even up here. Image, yeah. So an image and a line break, just because it doesn't really make sense if you think about what an open and a closed tag means. Like if you were trying to make something bold, for example, it kind of makes sense that you have a start position for your bold and then an end position for your bold, but not necessarily for an image. You just are going to show the image here. So there are a couple of things. So each of these are tags in the XHTML file, and there's some terminology for all of these things. This here is called what? I mean, yes, it's a body, but what is this? What's the term for it? Yeah, it's the element, exactly. The next one, BG color, how about this one? Yep, it's an attribute, and you can have multiple attributes in a particular element just depending on the element type. For example, image, you'll notice that there is an alt attribute and a source attribute. Next, it's always you have an equal sign after the attribute, and then a single or double quote, and then the value. Then you have to close that single or double quote. XHTML, there's actually a comment made just a few minutes ago that's a good point. Even HTML from the olden days was very common to have it on all caps, but it's the exact opposite in XHTML. Everything except the value should be in lower caps. So your element, your attribute name should all be in lower caps. It's easier for you to type, no caps lock, no shift key, nothing like that. So just go ahead and do it. There are a couple of required elements here in your... yes, question.
I'm just curious, will it fail the validity test or the well-formedness test if it's not all lower caps?
So, yes, it is actually a requirement that they are all lowercase. We can try to see... you'll notice that there are some exceptions like this doc type right here that should be in uppercase. Frankly, I think that... it's perfectly fine if you go to Moulin Rouge and copy this source and use it just for your own XHTML files, just because it's a very easy baseline. You're not going to be tested or anything like that on remembering how many slashes are between transitional and EN and that sort of thing, what has to be capitalized. It's just easier just go online, find a valid web page, and literally just copy it and go that way. But this is a really good question, so we can actually test this by copying the source, and keep that in mind for now. Remember that if we go to validator.w3.org, we are brought to this validation service, and this is how we are going to check primarily your source for validity errors. So you would be wise to try it on all of your pages before you submit them for projects. I mean, do it as many times as possible, and as we start getting into more dynamic websites with PHP, you'll notice that as the pages start to change because they're dynamic, you might start having a more difficult time trying to test for their validity because the XHTML itself, or what this will read as the XHTML of your page, will change. We'll get into that, I'm sure, much more detail in the following weeks. Anyway, from this page, there are a couple of actually very nice tools that you can use. Right here, the default one is to just check a particular web page's you can just enter in a web address or URL, a URL, and be able to check its validity. So we can do, I'll just copy this one, Moulin Rouge, and we'll check to see. It is tentatively valid XHTML transitional, and that is because you can scroll down to get some additional information, and there is a warning about the encoding. So, all right, well, I happen to have a web page that I know validates, and it's a web page for a different course, actually. just to plug this other course, cse7.org, you could see that from the autocomplete that I've been testing this other one like crazy. Revalidate. All right, so this one passes validation. There's no errors or anything like that. So even though David's was a very good example, there are some web pages that have gotten rid of that problem with the warning. So let's take a look at the very top here. So okay, you may recognize the very top, the doc type, HTML, all that stuff that basically is just copied. But there is also in the head, you'll notice that there is a new element called meta with the, one of the attributes being content that describes the particular character set of this. And it's just one of the things that the new XHTML type is trying to push, is trying to figure out what kind of characters are in a page, if it's like a Western Roman sort of set, or if it's Cyrillic, or Chinese characters, Japanese characters, what have you. That's from here. So you can actually ignore that specific warning, but if you want to get rid of it, you can just add this, and you won't have to worry too much about it. But so this is a good example. So here we have lots of other tags and elements and what have you, and so you can see that we have a couple of link tags up here for some different CSS. Also a shortcut icon, which I haven't actually defined yet, as a favorite icon. For those of you, how many of you have been to web pages and you notice that you see the little globe next to the URL up there? You notice that that globe changes to a particular icon. If you've ever wondered how to do it, it's with this tag right here, the link tag with the attributes rel to be a shortcut icon. You can actually set just a small 16 by 16 pixel image to be a shortcut icon. You'll have to figure out how to create an icon, but it's certainly a way to just give that extra little pizzazz to your own web pages, and that certainly will be something that, you know, it's just kind of cool, if nothing else. Kind of useless, but pretty fun and kind of cool. So of course we have our head, our body tag, lots of divs, lots of divs, lots of A tags, A elements, H references, and all of this sort of thing. Okay. So let's go back to the markup. What I was trying to show you before I got off into this huge tangent was that there are other things as well. You can also, before you even have a file on a particular server, you can upload it. So if you have an XHTML file saved on your desktop, you can upload it and do it that way. Or if you have just a somewhat short document, or if you want to verify the validity by copying and pasting, you can do that here. And so I'll copy the source from MalinRouge.com and paste it in here. And of course, we expect it to be the same. Except, okay. So it gives us, it doesn't give us the warning. It must be one of these. Well, it detects it automatically. So I guess, all right. Well, how about that? You learn something new every day. So it's not exactly the same. For some reason, it automatically detected the encoding as being UTF-8. Which is just kind of the default. But you can still keep that tag, and I'm sure that it would. So if we were to copy this source code from here, I'm sure that if we were to do this, it would also give us a valid one. Revalidate. And it's the same thing. And so you can still add that meta tag without any adverse effects. You would just get sort of a little extra something. There's something really pleasing about working on a web page for a long time and then getting this really nice green bar across the top of your validation page. All right, so any questions about this sort of validity or XHTML, anything like that? There are several good references for XHTML. If you go back to cs75.net and under the resources page, Keep going. XHTML. So there are XHTML and HTML tutorials, which I believe are from the W3 schools, and they are, quite a bit now. All you have to do really is, when you have something in mind that you want to do, you can try to figure out what tag, what element will be the best way to get to achieve what you want. And so you can check here in this W3 schools for a list of tags and elements, what they do, what their attributes are, what their values can be. But realize that anything but even the most basic attributes will most likely fail for cross-platform sort of. It would pass validation, but you, like David was talking about, this blink tag that's now become kind of obsolete. That happened first because I think Internet Explorer just stopped supporting it. And so all the other browsers that were supporting it eventually just followed suit. And so even though it was a valid tag, and it may still be a valid tag if you put it in an HTML page, you won't necessarily get that sort of effect. So this sort of thing can be, the blink, like David talked about in lecture, can be achieved with JavaScript and some fancy CSS that we'll go over later on for those of you that want to replicate dancinghamsters.com or whatever. But for now, just know that you can make a very well-designed site with just the very most basic tags. I mean, the default that we showed you with the doc type and the head and the body tags, but also just a couple of divs, the A tags for your links and some images. And that's, well, I guess you might need some lists and some tables, but other than that, there may not be a whole lot more that you really need to do without kind of overcrowding it, because that is due to the wonderful, wonderful world of CSS. So this is the XHTML source of the resources page on CS75.net. You can see that David here has actually linked to a number of CSS style sheets. You can see them here in the head. There's the UE ones that he loves to talk about so much, and our own styles.css. So let's just take a look at that styles.css. Was it? Nope. I forgot where it was located already. Memory of a goldfish over here. Let's see. CSS, styles CSS, okay. So you'll notice that it looks a little bit different than XHTML. And anybody remember what the difference is between XHTML, what David recommended you should use XHTML for, and what you should use CSS for? He made it somewhat clear distinction between the two, when you should use CSS versus when you should use XHTML. So XHTML really is just to kind of place the content of the page up on the internet, and the CSS is what you use to style it. You might use it to make columns if you would like to do that, to give it color, give it a background color, sort of give it borders, what have you. This way you're able to abstract that completely from your XHTML. So you could have very basic XHTML system like I was just talking about. You just can have very basic tags and just use CSS to completely change the way that it looks. And that CSS Zen Garden page is actually a wonderful example of this. All the HTML is the same. They just changed the style sheet to make it look drastically, drastically, drastically different. Okay. It's set up a little bit differently, so you can have a couple of different things. You can either have the elements, XHTML elements. You can have what are called classes, or you can have what are called IDs. Now, elements, whatever you apply to an element will apply to all of the elements in a particular page. It can get a little bit more complicated than that, but generally, like for example, here you can see A. What does the A element do, generally? Yeah, it's a link. Okay, so you can see that the color, you can kind of read it now. The A is a link, so you have a color set to a specific thing and no text decoration. Generally, text decoration is used to specify an underline. There's some other things as well. But then, this way, you can actually change the text decoration when the mouse is hovered over it. So that's how some of these websites are able to get that effect of having a link, and then when you move your mouse over it, it underlines that link. It's kind of a snazzy way to just draw attention to links versus text. But certainly you would want to color your links differently than the rest of the text, just to make it obvious what are links and what are not. A hover, that's just that specifies when the mouse is over it, etc., etc. So it looks like he did it an interesting way. Rather than setting the text decoration to be underlined, he actually set a bottom border for the element. And this, whenever you have a border, it references just the element that we're talking about. So you can have a div, which is just a particular division of a page. That can be a, you know, basically any size from the entire width of the page to just a couple of pixels long, and you can underline all of that with that border. So if we were to take a look, just give me 1 second, real quick. If we were to take a look at his, you can see that he has his links here, and they're blue, and if you put the mouse over it, it underlines it in somewhat of a nice border. Yes, you had a question.
The A definition at the top is,
yes.
You said there are three types of CSS style definitions, elements, classes, and
IDs. Yes.
So the A one at the top is an element style.
Yeah.
What is A colon hover?
So that's just it's being a bit more specific. I unfortunately don't know the exact terminology for it. But it's just being more specific.
It's another element style.
Yeah, it is another element style. And you can actually list several elements in a row. So for example, if you wanted to have your A hover, your A.image hover, so what might A.image be? So this is just kind of a compound element statement where it's saying that links that are images that are links as well that are hovered over have no bottom border. So in this way, he's able to tell that whenever there is text that is a link, you put a bottom border on it, or it's being underlined when you hover your mouse over it. But when there is an image that is linked, it does not do that. Like I said, you can actually create compound ones even from these. So let's say that for whatever reason you wanted your A element and your A hover to be exactly the same. Well, what you could do, is this text too small? Can everybody read it? No. All right, good. You can actually just kind of list them together. And let's see if he has an example of this. Maybe not. All right, so elements, so this sort of CSS definition applies only to elements. Now, you can have classes where, let's say you want only some elements to have a particular style, but not all of them. This way, what you would do in that case is you would define a class. So let's say that you have only some links that you want to color a specific color, and all the rest you want to be something. For the general page, you would want to define an element, because this would apply to all elements in the page. A class definition would only show you which ones are. You would define the ones for the class. So here we have, you can see this is a body element. It tells, what he's saying here is the font family of a particular, or of the text in the page. Let's see, so these pound signs are IDs, so we're going to skip over them. Now, dot FYI, so this is a class element, and you can tell because it has a dot in front of it, basically. So every time there is a dot FYI class, then it'll set the specific color and a specific font size. I'm not sure if he has that on this particular page, but let's see if we can find that. So the way that you would see the difference, okay, here. So here, this is again the source for the resources page in CS75.net. And the way that you're able to define when a particular element belongs to a CSS class is to actually use the class attribute. So you can see here that it says class equals text. Now let's see, look down there, it says A. So the second one here is a link element, and it uses a class of an image. So in this case, this is that A.image one that we just saw before, where it's not going to underline that specific image.
So the A.image is referring to the class, that
stands
after A?
Yes, so A refers to the element, dot image refers to the class of type. It refers to the class of images that are also belong to elements that are A. So if we were to set another element here, just anything else, like table, and call it class image, it would not, that same style would not apply to that as well, because it's actually different. It's a different element. It's a table element rather than an A element. Okay, so we know that at least on this page we have the text class. So let's move forward and look for .text. So here you can see that whenever he defines .text, he wants the font size to be 85% of the default for the particular page. There's a couple other ones justified. You can see he calls these formatting classes, so this must have something to do with the way that he wants the text to look. You can define what are called comments in CSS, and that is to use this \**. You'd close the comment by doing a star and then a \*, and anything in between is not considered to be part of the CSS. So anytime you write a note to yourself, I'm sure for those of you who are programmers understand this concept, but for those of you who are not, anything that you want to write to yourself to understand what you're doing, or so that you can come back and take a look at it later and understand what's going on, use a comment. And certainly it's a very, very good habit to get to, especially when we start getting into PHP, when your pages become more complex and more dynamic, you'll want to go back and try to remember what you did or why you decided to do something the way you did. And so commenting is very, very vitally important. Okay, so the last one is the last one are IDs. Nope, I shouldn't use that. Oh, this is going to be tough. Let's see, it was around the top, I believe. Okay. So when you have an ID, it's literally what it sounds like. It is just an identification of something on the page. So whereas the class, you can apply a class to any number of elements in the page. You can only have, in order to have a valid page, you can only have one ID on a particular XHTML page. And in this way, as we'll come to find out later, this is so that you can identify a particular element on a page later. You can use JavaScript to change the style or whatever, and without having to try to decide which of many elements it would be. So I'm not sure if we'll have contact IDs on this particular page. I kind of doubt it. Doesn't seem like the right kind of page for that. Yeah. Oh, we do. Okay. So it's at the, it looks like, I'm sorry, I can't read this very well. So this is referring to the part on the very far side up here where it is referencing his contact information. So on every page, this is great, because on every page he only has this part once. He only has one part on the page where he's defining it as contact. So he's able to define that with an ID of contact, and if for whatever reason he wants to go back in JavaScript and change the particular style of an ID, he will be able to do that. So just remember that classes you can apply to multiple elements. IDs you can only apply to one element. Now, as far as what CSS, as far as these commands that you can set in CSS, I recommend, again, the W3 schools. There's a link on that resources page, and from there you can find out what attributes for these classes and IDs are relevant and what the values, what the respective values for those would be. Yes?
What is the li telling us after the pound sign menu?
Okay, so this is another compound one. So the pound menu is a class, as we know, and the li is an element. It's a list element. So whenever there is a list element that somehow falls under the menu ID, then it is going to apply to this particular set of CSS rules. So let's go to an example that I'm a little bit more familiar with, and that's this website here, where, let's see. Mm-hmm. So at the very bottom here, I have a division whose ID is footer. And that's because I'm only going to have one footer on every page. And if I ever need to come back and change either the text with JavaScript, change the style, or what have you, I would be able to do that by referencing the ID. We can take a look at my CSS by going up to the top and copying the CSS file. I actually have a couple. One of the things that you may notice is that I actually have one CSS document that's dynamically generated with a .php file here. You see that? It's leads to some problems that we'll get into as we go a couple of weeks from now. But that this is used primarily because this website has a notion of themes, such that every time a new session is created, the colors change. So you can actually set different colors for this particular website. And one of the things that I'm hoping to that we as a group will be able to accomplish in section, especially as we get a little bit more into the Ajax-y sort of thing, is to apply some sort of a theme chooser to this website where you know, you guys will help me while I'm up here try to figure out how to be able to do this dynamically so that people can choose which theme they like the best, and it'll remember that in a session cookie. We'll be able to come back to it and just see the one that's least offensive to them, the photo that is least offensive. All right, so anyway, back to the CSS without going into too much of a side of an aside here is we'll just copy the CSS document URL. And you'll see here that this is my CSS. And so I haven't done so great of a job of commenting it as David has, but frankly, I haven't worried too much about it because it's actually somewhat simple of a CSS document. So let's look for that pound footer. So here again, this is an ID that's only applying to that particular division element, and I give it margins, which tells the margin left tells it, you know, how far it is from the left side, what to do with the text, and the amount of padding. So there is something that actually has confused me for a long time when I'm working with CSS, and that's the difference between margin and padding and borders and all of this stuff. So let's say you have a division that's maybe 100 pixels by 100 pixels, okay, 150 pixels by 100 pixels tall or something like that. The padding is the space that is inside of that division, at least in an ideal world. So this space right here is the padding. You can define that in one of many things. Pixels are probably percent, EM, which is basically a measurement of the font size. And so in this way, you can just have... you can indent your text a little bit with the padding in a particular div or what have you, whereas the margin is the space that is outside of the div. So let's say I have the browser window right here. The margin for a div right here would be from here to the border. So this is the margin. Now this div obviously has a border because we can see it of 1 pixel, and it's probably black and what have you. And, 1 pixel. But this is probably the first time, well, may not be the first time, but this is one example of where browsers get this differently. So in some cases, when you're trying to place a number of divs on your screen so that they all line up perfectly, so if we go back to the page, you'll see that I have here several rectangles that define the photo's location, the main body's location, and the navigation bar on the left. And so one of the things that, in order to achieve this sort of style right here where it highlights part of the nav, it's not actually a, it's just two rectangles basically where one of them doesn't have a border on the right side and the other one has a border, but this one has to overlap it to kind of get rid of the border on the left side. And this was extremely frustrating because the way that Internet Explorer calculates the combination of the margin, the padding, and the border is different than Safari and Firefox. And I don't know exactly what it was. It took a lot of futzing in order for me to get it just right. But I believe it's something like Internet Explorer doesn't calculate the border width size into the calculation of the space from here to here or something like that. So it's actually 1 or 2 pixels off just because I have a 1 pixel border, and that ruins this effect. I saw Chris in first. Okay, so we're still taping though?
Yeah.
Tape's still rolling? Okay, so I guess I'll just continue, and hopefully they'll just be able to catch it later. I'm sorry.
So do you have checks inside of your code for what browser is rendering it, and you use different HTML?
No, I do not use checks. I find checks to be very hackish, and they'll break very easily when a new version of IE comes out. I actually took the time to go through all of it and find the ideal combination of margins and widths and borders and everything to make sure that it worked in every browser. And
it may not look pixel for pixel identical in every browser, but it's pleasing and similar.
It looks right in every browser, and I believe there might be a difference in the... So let's see if I can move this web browser window over a little bit. So you'll notice that... Okay, I need to widen it a little bit because the photo's kind of big. So you'll notice that there's some sort of predefined space between the very far left of this image and where this text in the nav bar begin. And it's, I believe, this text and this left nav bar might be off by one pixel. But in the end, one pixel in that doesn't matter. I was just much more concerned about achieving this effect right here. And after I was able to do that, I just said, forget it. It's good enough for me. Yeah, exactly. So this is something to watch out for, and David has been talking about these UE resets that might be able to make this a lot easier to accomplish. I didn't know about it at the time that I wrote this site, so I haven't had a chance to try those, but he says that he uses it for CS75 and that he swears by it, so it will probably make your life a lot easier in this form of cross-platform work that you have to do. And if you can notice, I do my work on a Mac, and that's probably one of the harder things to do because if you write something that looks good in Safari, most likely it's going to look fine in Firefox. But one of the things that you'll notice is that IE is just an entirely different beast, and so I don't have Internet Explorer on my computer, so I have to go to work or I have to ask a buddy who has a PC to be able to check for this. So if you have a Mac, I really recommend looking on Internet Explorer, because I'm sure that's what David will be using to take a look at your websites, and you want to make sure that it's very good for him. Yes?
Does he use 7 or 6 or both?
I believe he uses 7. I don't think the rendering is that much different between 6 and 7. A lot of the stuff that was broken in 6 is still broken in 7. There's a lot of talk online about IE8 finally being standards compliant. How many of you are aware of the ACID-2 test? No, okay, so this is a test that it really just checks for a browser's capability to render very, very specific but esoteric CSS commands. And it's claimed to be not necessarily the end-all be-all of browser compatibility, but it does show you how well a browser may conform to the CSS standards. And luckily, we're using Safari here, and it passes. It says, hello, world. But if you try this in Internet Explorer, I think the entire page is red. I think half the face is missing. It just looks completely, completely different and wrong. And it's a very good example of just how messed up Internet Explorer is. And if I can just keep going a little bit on an even bigger tangent, so IE8, they're talking about the next version of Internet Explorer that should be coming out. And Microsoft has been trying to blog their progress with IE8 because web developers are becoming increasingly frustrated with this sort of cross-platform work that they have to do. And a couple weeks ago, they said, okay, IE8 passes the ACID-2 test. And lots of people were grumbling and said, okay, that's good. And a week later, I think they said, well, it doesn't technically pass the ACID-2 test. It just kind of does. And that's because apparently what they're trying to do, at least as of a couple weeks ago, is in order for IE8 to start rendering in a standards-compliant mode, you have to add an additional tag, an unsupported and not valid tag somewhere in your XHTML document that triggers something in IE8 to be standards-compliant. And this is kind of ironic, because if it's not a valid tag, and it's running in standards compliancy mode, but otherwise it will default to this sort of what's called quirks mode, this quirky mode that's broken and horribly, horribly outdated. I frankly don't know why David still uses IE. I tried to get him to switch, but he won't have it. So He was being very old school about the whole tabs thing. He said, what are these tabs? What are these tabs? I don't get... But anyway, back to CSS. So I think there was a question a long time ago about a compound CSS that I was trying to answer before I went off on like a 10-minute, 15-minute tangent. Let's see if I can find it. Okay. So you'll see up here that I have defined some CSS for the UL and the LI elements. So UL, somebody help me out. Does anybody know what that element is?
Unordered list.
Yep, an unordered list. Perfect. Okay, an LI is just an element that defines an item in the list or the list item. If you'll let me go back. Oops. Let's see. I think the lecture's here. So here's an example of some unordered lists. It's just a whole bunch here. So you'll notice that I list that I don't want any style. Normally they'll put little bullets or something, and I don't want any bullets. I just want it to be indented. And for the LI, I just have this margin so that between every list element, there's a bit of a space, 0.75 em, which is just a specific size. So remember that margin is outside of a particular element. This was a div, but this can also represent any element. You can consider a list element to just be to have a bounding box around it that you can define by just putting a border into it. So anyway, you'll notice though that this is also an unordered list, but it looks a little bit different. Instead of being left indented, for example, it's right indented. And in this, what I did here was I defined a div element right here as being a navigation bar. I defined that as an ID because I'm only going to have one navigation element on the page. Nav, okay, so here you can see this is my CSS for that particular navigation page's box. Feel free if you're trying to make a somewhat similar page to use the CSS because I've really wrestled with the IE thing for a long time. Anyway, you can see then there is a nav ID, but more specifically that applies to the unordered list elements. And so in this way, for all of the unordered list elements that I have in the navigation bar, this CSS applies to it. So in this way, you can have different CSS within IDs, within elements, within all sorts of things, and you can apply. So let's scroll down just a little bit more, and we have an even more compound CSS class. So you'll see that there is a navigation bar, but for a list item that has a class cell menu item or selected menu item, then it is going to be a little bit different. And you'll notice that the padding is a little bit different, the width is a little bit different, and it's actually right here. I think this is where I was able to get it to work in IE, was the differences, the 1 pixel difference between the selected and the not selected item. And that is because, again, of that border. I didn't use any strict browser checks. There was something down here that I used that preserves what's called, it's called Gecko preservation mode, and that's basically just a way of being, a way that Safari is able to handle something versus Internet Explorer. Excuse me, the way that these sorts of hacks work is, so if you remember back from the ACID 2 test, I said that it tests these sort of esoteric, not very well-known commands in CSS, or these attributes in CSS. And for those browsers like IE that don't necessarily respond to all of them properly, it shows that it's incorrect. And this is one of those cases where Safari understands what this means, but IE doesn't. So IE ignores it. So in this way, you can actually change some of the CSS for specific browsers without having to do a JavaScript browser check or anything like that, because people can disable their JavaScript and then you have to decide what to do with the page. So luckily I only had to use one little bit of a hack, but it works well enough that I was happy and happy enough to show all of you here. So I just wanted to show you this selected menu item, what that looks like in practice. So just so you know, that's this part here, and that's because that's the page that we're currently on, and it's the one that I wanted to look a little bit different. View source, cell, menu, item, you'll see that all I had to do was just consider it, just call it a class, the LI class, selected menu item. So you'll remember the compound part, it was pound nav, right? So it has an ID nav. Within that element, I'm sorry, this isn't tabbed very well, but within that element, there is the LI element with a class selected menu item, and it had that different thing. So I mentioned that there were several, there was another CSS document in there, which is that PHP. And this is another thing that I actually just struggled with last week because of IE doesn't properly deal with PHP style sheets. And so if I did this again, I honestly wouldn't, I'm not sure I would go this route. It's somewhat difficult. But here, this CSS style sheet is dynamically generated by a PHP script. And now you can see that this is where all of the color is defined. So remember, color, you can use words like black or red, but it has to be very simple. You can't use like Calypso red or anything extravagant like that. You actually have to be very specific. So if we just remember our colors, oh, too bad I don't have a blue. I do have a blue one. What did I do with it? Oh, here it is. All right. So we have first the pound sign, which means that it represents a color, and then we have two numbers, A through F. Oh, 0 through F, I'm sorry. 0 through F, 0 through F, that represent the red. And so this is, of course, in hexadecimal, which just means that 0 through F, if you actually counted, it goes from 9 to A, B, C, D, E, F. It's 16 unique numbers. So 16 times 16, you actually have 256 different combinations. And let's see, so we have red first, and then we have the two green elements, and then the two blue ones. And so you can actually define, if you go into Photoshop and you bring up that nice little color wheel and you click on a color that you really like, you can now decipher what it means just based on that particular thing. And so since it's 256 colors, it's 8-bit, which means it represents 24 bits of color information, which is pretty useful. It's about, you have about 17 million colors to choose from, just shy of that. So anyway, so looking back, you can see that I've defined all of the colors for this. And if we go down, it's going to make a little bit more sense, where you can see here for the nav list element selected menu item class, I actually have it look quite a bit different than the rest of the nav bar, where such that it has a border top, left, and bottom, right? And then a background color to match that of the body, which might be up a little bit. So right here it says CC, DFCC, move up, 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 CC, where's body? There it is. No, not that body. It's the content, because the content is basically where I put all the text, and you can see the background color is the same. And so that's how I was able to achieve that kind of interesting effect through CSS and XHTML.
Now, when you reference both style sheets, mm-hmm. in your HTML, I see that a lot of styles are the same.
Yes.
They have the same name.
Yes.
Do they conflict with each other, or which one takes precedence?
That's a good question. So I have two style sheets, and in each I have the same classes, or many of the same classes and IDs defined. They do not interfere because none of the attributes are the same. This is a colors.php, and in this I've only defined colors. The border is a little weird because it is actually defining, you know, it is actually changing it a little bit just by one pixel, but that I considered it to be a color because it's just showing a splash of color, whereas the other one was strictly layout and layout of the text and all of that. And so that way I was able to just abstract the colors enough to get that sort of theme implemented in the web page. Let's see. You can actually blow away previous attributes if I were to change it. So if I started throwing in some stuff like margins and stuff, I would wreak havoc and I would confuse myself because the things would look a little bit different. And So it should read it in order. So if whatever I had in the first, so if we go back to this source here, whichever style sheet I had first, it would read and read into memory. But if I had those same attributes and change the attributes slightly in the second one, it should blow away whatever was in the first one and just use the ones from the second one. Because it's just going to read it linearly like that. Let's see. Any questions about CSS, XHTML, any of that sort of thing? Okay, so I guess there are a couple of things that I can mention that might be useful. So from back in the HTML days, there was the B element, which allowed you to bold basically any text. It's no longer B. That's old school. Don't use that anymore. It is now strong, so it's called the strong tag. I have that somewhere. I'm not sure if that's on this particular page. Yep, it's right here. So you can see that for all of the dates. This is for a list of lectures for this course, and there's a list of dates that are listed as strong, so they're bolded. A couple of other things. The EM tag, which I believe stands for emphasis, is the new italics tag. So up here I have an EM tag, and you can take a look, scroll up to the top, and you can see that this part is actually italicized. Yes?
Why would you decide to do some stuff with, say, a strong tag?
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't you do the same thing inside of a CSS style?
Yes, I can do the same thing inside of a CSS style, but it's just a matter of saving keystrokes. So you'll see here that I have on one line some text that is mixed, emphasis and not emphasis. In order to do this with a CSS tag, or in order to do that with a CSS style sheet, rather, you would have to do what's called a span tag, which is span, and then you can either do ID or class or style, and then just set within that, because as you know, you can actually add CSS directly to style attributes within elements. But I think that tends to look a little messy when you start adding all of these quotes, and it just gets to be huge. I like to abstract these sort of things into as many files and divisions as I can. So here I could do style, and then I think it would be font weight, font dash weight, colon bold, colon, and then my text here, and then quit the span. And it's just, frankly, so much easier, rather than do all of that, to just do EM and close the EM. Same thing for the bolding and that sort of thing. But this is useful. Thank you for reminding me that the span style is useful, that you can apply style sheets or you can apply CSS to text inside of the XHTML. All of the same rules apply when you just have mixed amounts of text. But again, span tends to be kind of ridiculous in length when you start adding even just a couple of styles. There is actually a validator for CSS as well. This is very useful if you start having problems with your CSS or whatever reason. It's not actually in the same web page, but it is referenced. So we'll try... new tab. So we'll validate this web page. It's transitional. At the very bottom, there is a CSS validation service link. It doesn't remember it. So you just enter in the same. You can actually enter in an XHTML file, and it will get all the style sheets out of that, either by the link tags or built into the page itself. You can check it for validity, and it will tell you if there are errors or no errors. This is certainly something that you will also want to do, is validate not only each and every one of your XHTML files, but also your CSS. Luckily, it's easier because it just parses the XHTML file and gets all of them. Right, so let's see. Any questions about CSS or validation or anything like that? So, okay, so let's break for just a couple of minutes. When we come back, we'll, if there's no more questions, we'll probably do some stuff on DNS and just some other things like that, just to get everybody up to speed. Yes?
This is a slightly off topic, but it looks like you had hard coded the width in pixels, like the page width was 900 and then you had a margin of 50.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering what is a good recommended width now that everybody's getting ignored.
Right. Right. Yeah. So what? Yeah. So what's a good width? So, I kind of made a judgment call and just went for 900 pixels. That is because I'm limited by the size of the image that was at the top of the page. Whereas there are other sites that are not so limited by that sort of thing, such as CS75.net, where there's just this blue bar that can literally be extended with a div, or I'm not sure how David did it, but I'm sure it was with some sort of div with a similarly colored blue, and it can just be extended to grow to be the width of the particular page. So you really have to make a judgment call. I think nowadays they used to say that you have to code your pages for 640 by 480 for those sorts of things. That's so outdated now. Everybody has higher resolution monitors. I thought around 1,000 pixels would be a reasonable size. I don't even know what resolution this is at. It's probably close to 800 by 600 or something like that. And so it goes off a little bit, but that's sort of an unrealistic resolution as well.
It seems like there's so many technologies now that where you can just kind of scale photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to...
You can scale photographs, but, I mean, as you know, when you start making pictures bigger, they look pixelated and blocky, and so I rather would have it look sharp, and so even you can even have the browser scale it for you, but it does a very terrible job, I think, and it doesn't look as clean as it would if it were the ideal size.
I mean,
if
you started like a really big one and had it scale down,
You could start at a really big one, but then it's slow because it has to load a huge image, and then for slower computers to have to resize that down, you'll probably get some jerky scrolling and stuff like that. So just in the interest of speed and size, just taking all of these things into consideration, I just made a judgment call with 900 pixels. So okay, so let's go ahead and take just a quick 5-minute break, change tapes, we'll come back. Any more questions, and we'll go ahead. All right, well, welcome back, everybody. During the break, there were actually a number of very excellent questions. So what about tables? Are tables very old school? So like I was saying before, they are kind of old school. People now, especially the very, how shall I say this, pompous web programmers really prefer to use divs. But tables are just so much more intuitive to understand and to be able to process in your page. So you don't have to use strictly divs in this course. In fact, if you're just making sort of a simple two-column layout, it's probably a lot easier if you just use a table. You will want to check, though, your table across several different web browsers, because browsers interpret the border attribute of tables differently. So some you may see a border and others you may not, and you'll want to define that explicitly so that you're sure that it looks the same in every browser. Of course, you do have to realize that the table element has a border attribute, but that is in addition to and separate from the CSS border attribute, which you can also define for tables. So you'll have to play around with that to see which you prefer. If you prefer the look of a table border attribute, or if you prefer the look of a border attribute in CSS. Generally, I tend to prefer the CSS border, just because I have more control over that. I think in IE it tries to make the table borders look like it has a shadow or something to give it a sort of faux 3D effect. I'm not a huge fan of that, so my personal preference is to use CSS borders exclusively. But again, even if you define one here, you want to define it explicitly in your table attribute. Another thing is frames. So are frames very old school? There are So it is, but there are some uses still for frames. Usually, frames can cause problems with if you're trying to view the source of a particular page. There's a lot of sources that you have to view because you may have a couple of frames. Frames are basically like a bigger table for web pages, so you can actually have divided up your web page into four frames, for example, and each one you have separate XHTML sources. And so it's a little bit harder, especially if you want to go back and look to see what you've done. You actually have four frames to manage instead of just one. Also, it can cause problems with printing. So if you have a web page where people might be printing out the content, it's a lot better to use CSS in that case, because not only can you define a CSS style sheet for what is shown on screen, but you can write a completely different style sheet that's used by browsers only for printing. So this is actually it's actually wonderful when web developers do this, especially for newspaper sites or what have you, when they're actually creating lots of different things that might be printed out. But for example, this here, if David had created a print style sheet, and you can look that up on how to do it either on Google or the W3 schools, he can actually make it so that it doesn't look like this. It only prints maybe the text and maybe just this, the nav along the bottom of the page or whatever. You just make it different for a different medium completely, and that can be a wonderful tool. There's even some other styles that you can do and apply multiple style sheets depending on whether it's being printed or on screen or what have you. Yes?
I just wasn't sure what you meant by a print
style. So when you actually print it out on your laser or inkjet printer, you can actually have a separate style sheet defined in the XHTML so that you don't have to do anything different. So maybe you have one of those atrocious websites with the black background and the yellow font. You know that that's going to kill people's ink cartridges. If that's not what you're trying to do, if you actually want to print it out nicely, then you can define a different CSS that puts it black text on a white background. And I think that was it in terms of the questions. So are there any more questions regarding CSS? Oh, yes.
Can you specify a different style sheet for mobile devices that have little tiny screens?
Can you specify style sheets for mobile devices? I believe so. I'm not sure though. I think in many cases you may have to have a separate page that's actually defined, because I'm not sure that, especially for phones like the iPhone, which have a web browser built in, I'm not sure that it treats the CSS any differently. So in that case, you might have to do some sort of browser detection, active browser detection, and then actually change the style sheet for the user, or actually just have a completely different site or a mobile-specific site. But don't quote me on that. That's just my old-school knowledge, I guess. I don't think that's possible, though, at least in its current form. So I guess now would be a good time just to do, before we even get into a little bit of DNS, just try to demystify these divs a little bit. I found, after much struggling, that a div by itself doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I believe David said that it spans the width of the browser window. If it's just a div by itself, it spans the width of the browser window, and its height matches that of the content inside. And that by itself tends to be pretty useless. And so what you'll have to do with CSS is define where the div resides, you know, how far from the left or from the top it belongs. And so when you have a web browser window, as I'll just finish up here, it's the axis starts from the upper left-hand corner. So, and you have two dimensions from here, obviously not a third one, but you have a dimension in this direction, which is called basically left, and a direction this one, which is called top. So you can have something that's 10 pixels from the top, for example. You can have something that's 10 pixels left, and then that would be about, I'm just guessing, but it's about here, for example. So what you should do is nest your div. So you can have one div that's sort of a container for everything else. And the way that this current page is set up, I guess I'll have to erase some of this. is that you'll see I have the body, and then I have a div ID called the page. And if we were to look at the CSS, should be a good idea to do right about now, not only for your use, but also so that I can remind myself. Uh-oh. styles.css. So the page, you can see that it has a width of 900 pixels and the margin is so whenever you have an attribute that you can set some values, so for example a border or margin or padding specifically, so I guess mostly the margin and the padding, you can shorten it. So you can either do margin dash top, which is the margin from the top of the element, margin dash right, margin dash bottom, margin dash left, or you can do shorthand and just call general margin. And in this case, what it does, so we have, running out of room again, margin, then you can have x, y, z, and then a. I ran out of characters. That was not the smartest thing to do. So you have x, y, z, and a. And each of these numbers represents a specific location, and it always starts from the top and goes count, and it goes clockwise. So we have top, right, bottom, and left. Okay, so this way you save three lines, basically you save lots of typing, and you can just tell very easily. Now the great thing is that this is done actually pretty well, because in many cases, that since the axis starts from here, in many cases what you'll realize is that you'll only need the top, since you're building web pages from top bottom, or you may only need a margin from the top and the right, or something like that. And what you can do is you can actually shorten it. So you can actually have only two of these. So we can define what I have here is margin and then 25 pixels. So you'll notice that px is short for pixels, and then auto. And this, the auto part is replicated for not only y, but also z and a. So it's essentially just shorthand for saying auto, auto, auto. And basically this just lets the browser decide how much margin to place on each side. And in this case, that makes sense because I have a div inside of the page, and I don't care how much margin is from the right side of the browser to the left side, especially since I've defined the width of this particular division, right? So I'll have to erase all this now and actually create my the page division. So it's 25 pixels from the top, and yep, 900 pixels wide. I shouldn't draw bottom on this quite yet though. All right, so let's take a look at some of the others that we have. Font family, I'm just defining a font family for this entire course. Everything is Helvetica. It's kind of a very nice cross-platform font. There's many that you can choose from. Define a font size and a line height, which basically means that I just want stuff to be not double-spaced, but like 1 1/4 spaced. All right, so moving on. Next, I have a couple of divs. I have a title, which if you remember is the title of the course, and then the header, which includes the photo. So I have a look at the title and the header. This is mostly just font stuff, and I did want to define explicitly that there's a 0 pixel margin on every side, so that way right up against it, there is that text. You can also see that I did a text align right, so that's how I was able to just very easily right justify it. What was next? Header? No padding and a height of 250 pixels. So you can gather from this that the image is actually about 900 by 250 pixels wide. Except not really. You'll remember that there was a border around it, and this is one of those times where IE gets it differently from other browsers. And I forget which one is which, but in some cases, they put the border on what is essentially the inside of the page, which means that 2 pixels are cut off on some browsers, and on other browsers they put the border on the outside. So rather than being 900 pixels wide, it's now 902. And I bet it's probably IE that does it that way. And then so that way you are actually showing those 2 extra pixels of width on either side. So here, this is where it starts to get interesting, because you'll remember that I had essentially 2 columns. I had the content column on the right within this. So here I have my picture, you know, of me doing something cool. Yay. And now I have 2 more divs. So if we look, I next have defined the nav div and then the content. And so through CSS, even though these are one right after the other, you have to use CSS to be able to define where exactly it shows up on the page. So let's take a look at how you would create columns with a div. Nav. The important one is this very first attribute called float. So it floats left of the content. So some of the important things that you have to define...
Left of what content?
Of the content div. So if we go back to the view source, or the source of this page, I have... Remember, inside... I am now talking about inside of this, the page div, right? And now I have already defined and gotten rid of the title and the header. I now have 2 divs to handle, which is this first one, the nav bar, and then the content, which contains the actual text for the website. And so there's a couple of things that you have to be aware of when you're creating a float, and that is that the width of both has to fit inside of the originating div or the originating page. So if you've somehow defined the body of the page to be a certain number of pixels wide, you have to be sure that your columns fit in it. And this is why I created this sort of larger div, just because I was able to put all of this stuff within it and let the browser manage, you know, how much space it should put on either side of all this stuff. It just sort of takes me away from that problem. Okay, so the content and nav. So let's just take a quick look at these. So we have float left, we have a specific width of 160 pixels. Let's see, do I have, there's no margin, there's 20 pixels, but where's, there's some 20 pixels for the padding, but which sides are those on? Top and left, very good, yep. And then the right and the bottom has no padding. And so, unfortunately, even though you can see that there's kind of a pattern here, I can't shorten this because I didn't want the left to have any padding. And this makes sense. If you go back and take a look, you'll see that all of the left justified, or all of the content in this div, is actually just about 20 pixels away from the leftmost part of where we imagine the page div to begin. So we have about 160 pixels of width and 20 pixels padding from the top and the left. So now this is starting to take shape, very similar to what we were seeing before. Is there anything else interesting? So I've just defined what I want all of the text to look like in there, and that's fine. It does it for every... So I should mention that every time you set an attribute, especially for font or for color or something like that, every nested divider gains the attribute of it's just basically grandfathered in from all of the previous ones, unless you explicitly define otherwise in the nested divs. So you'll remember we talked about the unordered list for the nav. Now we'll look at the content. Here I just did padding 30 pixels. So what does this mean? Where is the padding? Top. Yep, right. It's inside the div, but it's more than just the top. Remember that, because I didn't do padding top, it was that sort of thing where I said that it's copied for every other one. So it's 30 pixels on the top, on the right, on the bottom, and on the left. I saw your hand up. I'll get to you in just one second. So I have about 30 pixels, which is a little bit more than that 20 pixels. And so all of my text and stuff sort of goes in here, and so that gives sort of a visual white space from which people can just rest their eyes, I guess. I saw a question.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, terrible. Okay, yeah, TRBL, top, right, bottom, left. That's very good. That's good. Okay. So margin left, this is another part of the float. So I actually had to move this particular div over 200 pixels from the left part, but what is from the left of what?
From the left of the containing div.
Right, from the left of the containing div, which is the page up here. So it's 200 pixels from here, but something seems wacky, doesn't it? Because if you remember,
60 plus 25 is just 185. So the width of that left-hand part, I think the padding was 25 and the width was...
Yeah, I think it was actually 20 and the width was 60.
Oh, okay.
All right, so if we add all of that together, we get 180, right? So why do you think this space is more than the space of this div here? Any ideas? Yeah, it's simpler than that. I just gave space for myself when programming this, because if they touch together, it's at that point that you start running into these problems between IE and Safari. Just having a little bit of space, even just 10, 15, 20 pixels between these two, allow me to sort of give myself room for error between all of these web browsers. I'm sorry?
Is there a code for that? Do you specify?
Yeah, it's specified by the content. The margin left is 200 pixels.
The space just stays, it's just
sort of unallocated space, and the background from whatever's the background in this particular case shines through. But since I defined, if we were to look at the colors file, you'll see that the page is defined as having a particular set of colors, and that is not only serves as the background for the nav bar, but also for this blank space, so it looks continuous and like there's nothing there. You'll see a little bit later that when we look at the selected menu item, which I guess we should probably do, there's a little bit more trickery involved. So the width here, so let's start doing the math here. So we had a left padding of 20 pixels, right? 20 pixels here. And the total width of this div was 160 pixels. Okay, so right here is where we expected that selected menu item. Remember, that's the one that goes all the way across to give it that sort of funky shape. We expect it to start here, but let's take a look. So we've defined a width of 139 pixels. It's not as evenly shaped as all the rest, and that's because the border actually adds a pixel of width to it, and also we have the right padding there. Let's see. So it's 139 pixels. You can see that there's padding on every side. 20 pixels plus the, 21 pixels. All right, so here we have, the width of this, all right, so we have 20 pixels here, right, from the far left side of the page to where it begins, and then that's where this part starts here, so the width is 139 pixels. You add the padding together with that, and you realize that it actually is a length of 200 pixels. And so if we were to give all of this stuff borders, you'd realize that this sort of goes over the div of this other one. And that's okay, you can do that. That might cause you some frustration if that's not what you intended to do. And it'll certainly cause some headaches if you're trying to figure out the math. You're saying, well, why doesn't this stuff all add up? But in this case, after futzing, it tended to work. Okay, so we're almost done. We did the content and the nav bar. And remember that if you wanted to do two columns, yes?
In hreflink, how come you don't have a PI extension like .html?
Oh, so in the hreflink, why don't I have a .html extension? That's a good question. So I actually have... I have a couple of settings on the server that tell... I don't have separate files, okay? I have one index.php file that reads a bunch of the... I have a bunch of smaller files that hold the content of the web page. When... if I were to go to index.php... Let's see if this works here. I hope I didn't deactivate it. And then a question mark. In the future, you'll learn that every time you have a URL and then a question mark, that means that you're about to send some data to the particular web page. And it makes sense mostly only for dynamic websites because, in this case, it reads the data, determines what to do with it, and then it will change the content. So if I just do index.php, it shows me just the home page, right? But if I do a question mark and then define the page as being, I think it's lectures, you'll see that it actually changes to lectures here. And that's because the PHP file reads a different data file from content that's on the web server, and then it just outputs that instead of the default. But this is very ugly. It's not easy for people to remember. If people are going to this class, it's easier to remember cse7.org/lectures rather than /index.php. Question mark, was it? Was it a pound sign? So what the server does is every time there is something after the slash, if it doesn't exist as a file or as a folder, it remaps it basically. So let's say I have I'm going to cse7.org/ and then, you know, some string here, so XXXX or whatever. What the server does is it does what's called a rewrite, and this is a function of the Apache server, and it's actually possible to do with some of the configuration files on the Apache server. It rewrites that and masks it as being cse7.org/index.php ?p equals and then that string. And so in that way, my file, index.php, is able to parse the data, figure out which page we're referring to, and show that content. But this way, it just makes it so much nicer, so much neater. And in fact, CS75's website does the very same sort of thing, where you go to lectures, and he has a trailing slash. I didn't care if it was a trailing slash there or not. It'll show up to be the same thing. But it's the same sort of idea where that is passed along to, he might actually have an index.php in the lectures, in which case that lectures is defined as a folder. And then from there, whatever dynamic site is generated. So just because you see a slash and then something like that, you can't know for sure whether or not it's an actual folder that's referencing a file inside of it, or if it's just being rewritten. And in fact, many blog sites, if you frequent blog sites, they have that sort of, they call them permalinks. They're always this really long link with like slash the year, slash the month, slash the date, slash the title, and it'll end slash. And it's the exact same thing, where that data is being transferred to basically just an index.php file or some other dynamic file that's getting that information and showing it on the page. But it just makes it look a lot nicer rather than having all of that mess. So now that you know the intimate workings of my website, let's move on to the very last CSS part, which is the footer. So you see down here I have a div id equals footer before I close all of the divs, and then finally close the body. Okay, so here I've asked the text align. I wanted it to be centered, but I also wanted it to be centered relative to the content here on the page. So you can see that I've defined the margin to be 200 pixels left. So it's essentially the same thing, but here I have that content that ends here. Then I have another one that's the footer, add my footer. And then of course the page div ends shortly thereafter. It might actually end right after the footer ends right here, so this is not technically correct. Like that. Okay. So I have a padding in there. I wanted the text to be centered. And if you can look into even more detail by going into the colors.php and determine that it's not. It has no border and or a background color. So it inherits the background color from the page, which happened to inherit the background color from the body. So it's all the same background color. I'm sorry? Yeah, this is the footer right here where I have Creative Commons, some rights reserved, blah, blah, blah. And in this case, yes?
So far with the stuff that we've been talking about, we haven't introduced any dynamic HTML. We're not using PHP, for instance.
That's correct.
So if we were constructing pages that just use XHTML and CSS like this, we can view them in our browser without serving them up through a web server. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. Yeah, these pages are not dynamic, so you can load them up. They're very, very, very portable. You don't have to have a server that processes them. You just have to have a web browser that interprets them. And remember, that's what David was talking about, that these are not, if you've done this, these are marked up languages. There is a significant difference between just something that's being marked up where an interpreter basically just reads it and displays it versus a programming language that actually has to be processed by the computer and actually run. All of the commands have to be run. It is possible on Macs and on PCs to set up a server such that you can run PHP, MySQL, all of these technologies and test it all on your own computer. I suspect that it would be easier to almost just write the pages directly on the server. And this is a good transition into talking about SSH, because with SSH, you can actually log into your server and remotely create, edit, remove files. You have to kind of overcome your nerves a little bit if you haven't worked with the command line at all. But this is for Mac OS X machine, and so I've just loaded up the terminal program. In this case, I can just automatically log into a computer with SSH. On Windows, you would have to use, there's various SSH programs. I believe one of them that we might recommend is PuTTY. I'm not too familiar with them, so I'll have to defer to the staff mailing list for more information on that. Yes?
How did you get the screen
How did I get it transparent? There's actually in the terminal, there's a number of settings that you can set for all sorts of making it look all sorts of funny things. I was bored one day many years ago and just set it to this, and I've been too lazy to set it back to anything else. So anyway, the general form of SSHing is to use the command SSH and then your name or your username and then @ and then the domain name. So if we remember, actually we'll just go into this, since we've been talking about the csc7.org, we'll just log myself into this one. I've shown you this much from it, I might as well just go all the way. So sometimes you'll get this host error from it, and what this is just basically a security thing. Almost always you can say yes to this, and you may have a button in Windows that says allow or always allow. In that case, it might be okay to just say always allow, just so that way you don't always have to do it. My password. All right, so here we are. So there's a couple of commands. Anybody remember the list command? LS, perfect. Okay, so we can see that I have, if you remember from the panel, the CS75 panel, you actually saw the same thing. There was domains, IMAP, and public HTML. Here, let's see if I can change the color to make it a little bit more legible. It'd be kind of funny if after all of this time, what gets me to change it is this. Let's see. Maybe not work so well. Okay, so I'll just have to reread it to you. So you can go into a particular directory by using the cd command. Cd and then public. Well, I want to make sure I want to go into the right domain. So cd domains and then cd csc7.org. So now I'm in the folder that represents this domain. Now do another ls. There's a whole bunch of files. All of your files should go into the public HTML. So we'll do a list in here. And you'll see that it's very simple, this site. There's an index.php, a new theme.php, and if you remember when I clicked on that image at the top, that's what changed the colors and stuff. That's what this does. It basically destroys the session, tells it, it randomly picks a new theme, and it just runs from there. There's that styles folder, and there's the one that I really didn't want anybody to know was there, but the data folder, which contains all of the information, all the downloads, all of the files that contain the content, that sort of thing. So David seemed to prefer VI. I prefer Nano for modifying files. So you can do the command nano and then index.php, for example. We open it up. It's just basically an online notepad. That's all this is. Take a look down here. This is basically your menu, so to speak, but you can't click on it. It's all text-based. You see the little caret, like this says caret C. It's the little top hats there. That represents the control key on your keyboard. Okay, so whenever you see control R, that means, or whenever you see caret R, that means you hit control R to initiate that command. Exit, as you can see, is control X, and write out is a fancy, nerdy way of saying save. So every time I want to save it, it's not control S, but in this case it's control O for write out. So here we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves if I let you read all of this, but this is the PHP file for this particular index.php. So maybe let's quit out of this and we'll just go into the styles folder and take a look at the styles.css. And so here now I can modify the CSS of my particular file. If I make any modifications, maybe I'll add a comment. This is cse7.org's style sheet. And the comment, now I can save it. It says file name to write. Yes, that's the one I want. Now it's saved, and now we can go back here, check the styles. Did I do something wrong? Backslash instead of L. Really? Oh, the angle. There we go. So now you can see that I have the comment up there. And so this way you don't have to... There's ups and downs to this by doing this. When you do this, you don't have a local copy. If in the very extremely rare instance that our server crashes and we lose everything, you will not have a copy of your files. You can, of course, get them by downloading them from the panel or by using SFTP and downloading them. But the upside is that you can change this almost anywhere that you have access to an SSH program or a Mac or Linux or Unix computer that has SSH. You can just log in, make your changes, and be done with it. So this is definitely a great thing. I highly recommend taking the time to learn SSH and those commands, but there's not very many commands. There was ls for list, cd for change directory, and nano or vi for text editors. There's also some others. Emacs is a very heavy, very feature-rich one, but a lot of people prefer that. Emacs? They're all kind of similar to each other. I think Emacs is more of a beefed up nano. The commands are a little bit different, like to quit. I think there's a second command you have to do, Control X, Control C, or something like that. It's just Pico, similar to Nano. Okay, that's right. So Pico is similar to Nano, but I don't know enough about both to be able to tell you the differences between the two. But Nano's nice. It's lightweight. It's quick, and basically you're able to get this sort of thing done quickly. So I did Control X to quit. Right here, it very conveniently shows me where the location of my folder is. You may not be able to read it, but you can see danallen@cs75.net. That's remember that in Project Zero, you're basically pointing your domain towards the cs75.net's computers via the name servers with DNS. And so for that reason, even though I SSH'd into csc7.org, it actually shows up as being cs75.net. So don't worry too much about that. Next, it shows me the path that I'm in. Right here, there's a tilde. That just basically means that it's your home folder. Unix, Linux, Mac OS computers use the little tilde to represent your home folder. And then there's a set of folders from there. You can also find out what folder you're in at any time by using the pwd command. Print, and that'll print your directory onto the screen. So I guess we'll just take a brief second to talk about DNS. So what happens when I type csc7.org into my web browser? Oops, I want to erase that. Any suggestions? What does it know what to do? I mean, obviously in the end it shows me this, but...
On your PC, when you configured your network, you told it where one or two DNS servers were located.
Right, so optionally you could have told your computer, especially in an academic environment, you may have told it where you have DNS servers. So we have my computer here, my cool laptop. And so now I want to go to csc7.org. It basically just broadcasts this to the DNS server. And if you ever notice, if you look in the TCP/IP properties of your computer, the DNS servers are always represented in IP addresses, because that's the only way that these computers know how to communicate with each other, is not by the domain names, but by the IP address. So it asks the local big bad boy DNS server, where is csc7.org? The DNS server will give it a reply. It'll either say, if it knows the IP address, it'll give it the IP address. If it does not, it will say, I have no idea, IDK, I don't know, try this DNS server, so DNS server X. All right, so then it goes back to this computer. This computer will try again at the next DNS server. And in this case, it really depends on how this particular DNS server was configured. Let's say I'm here on Harvard's campus, as I am. I do csc7.org. I kind of doubt Harvard's servers might know where the location of my computer is. So it asks the Harvard DNS system. It says, I don't know. So it goes to the main DNS system for .org here. It says, okay, .org, where is csc7.org? And it says, I guess this one's a very good example because it's not very many layers of having to ask DNS servers, but this would have to know, basically, because this is a root server. Okay, let's do, instead of csc7.org, let's do that panel.cs75.net. Okay, so it's the same thing. It asks Harvard servers. It may not know. So instead of going to .org, it'll go to .net. It asks it. It says, okay, well, I don't know where panel.cs75.net is, but I know that that cs75.net has DNS servers at this particular location. Now, cs75.net has its own DNS servers. And from here, it would be able to say panel.cs75.net is at 1.2.3.4, for example. And then finally, after all of these steps, the web browser will actually be able to make contact with a particular IP address, and from there be able it'll be able to go from there. A couple of other things. So if we actually go to cs75.net or panel.cs75, you'll notice that it forwards me to panel.cs75.net :2222. What does that :2222 mean? Ideas? It represents what's called a port. So one server can have, so one server box or one computer that's can serve multiple services. It's kind of a cumbersome way of saying that cs75.net may be one computer, but not only is it doing HTTP, which is serving us our web pages, it's also serving, what other services have we used today?
FTP.
Yep. So in this case, it's SFTP. It's a secure version of FTP. There's another one that we did, just demoed. SSH, yep, secure shell. And in this case, there's also a service on port 2222. And so traditionally, what port does HTTP operate on? Yeah, 80, very good. So for pretty much every standard configured server, if you go to a particular site and do :80, it's going to be the same thing, just because it's requesting HTTP access on that specific port, and on that port is where the HTTP server is running. I guess you might be able to think of it, I guess, as a bay where there's many places that a ship can dock. In each dock may be a different service, and it just depends. It's kind of like that port number. You can just dock your ship at a different port, get a different service, and move on into the next one. Unfortunately, SFTP and SSH have their own port numbers, but you can't access them with the web browser. Why might that be? What if I do csc7.org:, and then what's SFTP? I think it's 23 or 22. What would happen then? Nothing, because the web browser doesn't understand that protocol. It only knows how to speak HTTP and HTTPS. Now, there's some, Internet Explorer might know how to do FTP, in which case you could access FTP servers based on that port number, but that's sort of just extra, that's sort of fluffy. So anyway, now you'll notice, though, that this web browser does understand what's going on port 2222. So what does that imply to you? So what kind of service is this running?
Secure HTTP.
This is actually a secure site, but that's sort of coincidence. It actually runs just as well. So it's actually, David actually enabled secure HTTP in this case, just because to secure basically the passwords that are being sent here. But if I do this, okay, well, this is also secured, but basically this is, on this port, there is another web server running, or it could be the same web server, but just allowing access on a different port that directs it to a separate looking web page. And in this case, it is an HTTP server, and it's being sent to you over the secure intertubes, or the secure web. So that is just a very basic rundown of DNS and ports and all of that sort of thing. You can change the port numbers for almost every service and almost everything that communicates over TCP/IP. So, for example, SSH or SFTP, you can change the port number. Maybe from home you're running a FTP server that you don't want Comcast to figure out, and if I may say, they usually only check for services running on low port numbers. That's because almost everything that you use over the internet has to use a port. So your AIM services, for example, are sometimes run on some ridiculously high port, like, I don't know, 50,000 or maybe not that high, but something like that. And so Comcast and these sorts of places don't really care if you're running a service at that high. So you can kind of fool them, even if you're your terms of service says that you're not going to run an FTP or an HTTP server. You can fool them by running it on a very high port so that it doesn't raise any flags for them, and then you can just access it with a web page by addressing to a specific port, or from your SFTP program or whatever service you happen to be running. Of course, I'm not condoning that you destroy your terms of service contracts with them, but sometimes when you're in a bind, you know, you gotta do some funny things to get files or what have you from one place to another. That is one of the ways to do them. You can, so let's see, on a Mac, I believe, where is terminal? I'm not sure if this will allow it, but there's a command called netstat that shows you where, what kind of connections your computer is running to other servers. This is actually netstat on the server, so we can see all sorts of connections here which don't. So here we can see there's a number of services running, SSH, HTTP, there's, and you can see that there's actually some subdomains here as well, VPS. And also there are some connections to far away addresses. Let me try doing this on my current computer. So to exit out of an SSH session, all you have to do is type logout, and it'll close the SSH section, or I'm sorry, the SSH session. Let's try netstat here. So here we can see that I've got a bunch of stuff running. This may not be terribly interesting. So right here, I have foreign address is po10.mit.edu. So you can see that I have an open and active connection from my mail client to MIT's servers to be able to tell, to be able to continue checking mail. Let's see, I think there's a way to get even more information. It's been a while since I've done this. No, that's probably about it that's interesting in terms of netstat. But anyway, just know that different services run on different ports. And even more important is that you can run a web server. You don't have to change. It's not a different service for these dynamic web pages. It kind of depends what the server is capable of. Our server is capable of hosting HTML or XHTML files, but also being able to process these PHP files and what have you, and then serve the resulting HTML file. And we'll learn much more about this in the upcoming weeks. It'll serve the processed file to the client computers. Any questions about DNS, SFTP, SSH, panel.cs75.net, XHTML, CSS? Lots of buzzwords? Nothing. Great. Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. I hope to see you all on Monday and specifically next Thursday when we will continue with live sections.